We don't know who we are. And this self-hatred is deep. It is deep, okay? And so this self-hatred really comes out and carries us all the way through undergraduate school, graduate school, PhD, MD, LL, whatever the case may be. So my first question to the individuals, how do you start? Work on yourself. Then your community.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Tightrope. I'm Tricia Rose, and you are now joining us for part two of a fantastic conversation that Cornel West and myself had with Hakeem Madhubuti. And it was just such a riveting conversation that we decided to make two episodes out of it because it went on long enough for us to really give you lots of fantastic background around Third World Press and the history of his relationship to the civil rights movement and Black power. It's amazing. Great conversation. We hope you enjoy it. Let us know on social media. Take care now. Bye-bye.
I just wanted to make sure I told you that story because, you know, we often think everybody starts out reading, I don't know what, you know, but people are reading you. They might be saying they're doing something else, but they're starting reading you. But I was going to ask you, how can we best pass on this legacy of institution building? Because it's a different moment, right? I mean, you bought land in a city that nobody can buy land in the city no more. I mean, the prices are untenable, right? So what can we do? Or if you had to imagine that you had a, you know, a Haki who was 20 right now,
okay,
or a sister, right, who's, you know, what would you tell us to tell them to do to build for the future what you have already built for the past, present, and future now?
Thank you for the question. I think that the first thing is to build yourself. If you don't know who you are, anybody can name you. So it's important that you start with self. I can walk into anybody's home, most certainly in the Black community, and within 5 minutes, I can tell you exactly where you are culturally, politically, historically, and so forth. I'm going to walk in your home. The first thing I want to know, is it clean? Is it clean? All right. And then I'm going to look on your walls and see, are there images on your walls that reflect the best of you and your culture, Black visual art, photographs, whatever the case may be. Then I'm gonna look on your bookshelf if you got a damn bookshelf, because that defines what you're reading, defines you, okay? Then I'm going to your music. What kind of music you listen to? Are you listening to the great musicians that we created in our culture, our booty call music? What are you listening to?
Well, then a little bit of both.
Okay, that's all right. Okay, no. I'm serious. I mean, I know your work, but I'm saying that's fine with the best of hip hop and the best of rap.
Oh, okay? You know, I'm with you on that now. Yeah, you okay. know.
Then I go to your movies, especially the movies that are wrapped up in a brown paper bag. You know, what are you looking at night? Mm-hmm. All right. But to really tell where that family is, where that individual is to go into the children's room.
Ooh.
What's on their walls? Mickey Mouse, Darth Vader, and Donald Duck. That's why we confuse. We don't know who we are. And this self-hatred is deep. It is deep, okay? And so this self-hatred really comes out and carries us all the way through undergraduate school, graduate school, PhD, MD, LL, whatever the case may be. So my first question to the individuals, how do you start? Work on yourself. Then your community. Who lives next door to you? Who lives, I mean, and your family, your extended family also. That's how you build institutions. So if you look in the book, there's a picture of the brothers from the National Black Holistic Society. And what we did for over 10 years, we had these retreats in upstate New York. We brought 300 or 400 people together to essentially work on themselves. That's when I became very close to Betty Shabazz. Betty Shabazz and I were like brother and sister. I mean, she was a little bit older than me at that time. But the point is that that's when we became very close.
There it is.
Because of these. That's it right there. Those brothers there. These, what we did, we took $300 a month out of our pay, put it in a pool, and began to do this holistic work.
Okay? Mm.
You see, I mean, so these are individuals saying we got to build something, we got to do something for ourselves. And that's how it starts. But you got to have a solid cultural base right. of knowing our culture and our people. Then you won't make mistakes. You won't come in some place and say, okay, I got the answer. You are going someplace in the community and you say, let me listen first.
All right. Or maybe I got a question rather than an answer.
That's it. That's it. Indeed. All the time. All the time.
But you've always exemplified to me though, brother, somebody whose love for Black people cuts so deep that you never ask them to love you back, but love Black people because they're worthy of being loved. Because when I think of even the Black opposition to what you've had to do, the Black middle class, the Black bourgeois opposition, I'll never forget your words at the end as part of the eulogy for the great Mary Baraka in Newark. When right. you looked over at the coffin and mm-hmm. said, Mary, the House Negroes are back and they back in charge.
They're back
you
in charge. That
line? That's right. You remember that line?
That's right.
Ooh, I was sitting next to Eddie Glaude and I just said a similar kind of thing because I said he never sold out. He never ever sold out. We didn't always agree with that, brother, because he could go off and do his thing.
But Amiri and I didn't talk. We didn't talk for 10 years. You know, I was in the Congress of African People at Mary Baraka. And Mary was essentially the head of the Congress of African People. He came to Chicago. We had a conference here. And that's when he said, I'm leaving. I'm becoming a Marxist-Leninist.
And Marxist-Leninist, yeah.
He talked about me so badly and wrote about me. And my wife said, don't answer. Don't answer. And so about 10 years later, we were in New York building the Black Writers Union. The White and Black Writers Union. I walked past a restaurant where Amina and Amiri were sitting down eating, drinking tea, I think. Anyway, Amina right now said, Haki, Amiri's in there, want to talk to you. And that's when we got back together. And we published three of his books. So we've been through a lot together. And he, like you say, he's a brilliant brother. He was a brilliant brother.
Oh, yeah.
And we ended up publishing Brilliant Flame, a book on his life. Because remember when I was at the memorial, I say, let's do something for him. And we brought it out. The book is still in
front. You brought that text out. But right. say something about the worst of the Black bourgeoisie. We don't trash any people. We don't trash any classes. But we keep track of the deeds, you see. If you see greed, if you see cowardliness, if you see callousness, even among the Black middle class, you have to be critical of it. And you have been struggling with this in terms of your own institutions and in terms of your larger critique of the American empire and your critique of Black politics in the name of Black poor and working people.
The problem is we want to always be praised and given credit for whatever we do for the Black community. I mean, it's just like the brother that went down to Morehouse and gave the scholarships.
Oh, Brother Smith,
who's not who's now in some tax trouble, as you know.
Right.
But see, for me, that was fine. But with the kind of money you got, that's not enough. All right, number one, yes, pay for their tuition, but go across the street and pay for the tuition of the Sisters of Spelman too. All right? And then pick another school, say FAMU. I mean, have the same problem. See, the kind of money he has and the kind of money that the Koch brothers have or the kind of money that, you know, the Amazon people, that's obscene.
Oh, yeah.
That is obscene within the context of the kind of suffering that not only Black people and brown people and poor people are experiencing in this country. You see what I'm saying? And then, so you got a McConnell. So I'm saying that one of the Kochs came out, this was in the Wall Street Journal last week. He has a new book out and now he's admitting his mistakes. You know, I know, you know, yeah.
Well, yeah, please.
Right, we reversed.
That wasn't no mistake. That wasn't no mistake.
Not.
It wasn't no mistake. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Not.
I just
but you're right. My point is, if that's a mistake, then let's reverse it and get rid of Citizen United, because your group helped bring Citizen United into existence. If that was a mistake, then let's get rid of McConnell. All right. How do you do this? If you can't get rid of him, certainly with your money, you can neutralize him. Okay.
Right.
And so my point is we only do what we've been taught to do. And we as educators have got to develop structures, you know, that we can come into where we don't have all the answers, but after 50 years, we got some of the answers. See, what happened to me, when Don't Cry Scream came out in 1969, it sold over 75,000 copies in the first year. What happened, Ebony did this big spread on me in the March of 1969, and the book just took off. Gwendolyn Brooks wrote the introduction for it. Paula Geddings, who is not the Paula Geddings that we know now, was working at Random House. Toni Morrison was working at Random House. Paula Geddings came to Chicago to recruit me for Random House. I told Paula, I'm not leaving Broadside Press. Gwendolyn Brooks, we had talked Gwendolyn Brooks, and she had made a decision on her own to leave Harper and Row. Gwendolyn Brooks left Harper and Row and came to Broadside Press. So how am I going to leave Broadside Press and go to Random House? But I told Paula, I've never been to New York. Let me come to New York. I want to come to New York. She brought me to New York, and the first person I met in New York at Random House was Toni Morrison.
One and only.
Toni Morrison, yeah, she had not published The Bluest Eye. She hadn't published The Bluest Eye. She was an editor at Random House. And I walked in, my name was Donnell Lee at that time. She said, Don, we're waiting on you. We're waiting. I said, I'm not coming. I wanted to come to New York, but I'm not leaving Broadside Press. And that was the problem right there. Not the problem, but that was what happened when I did not get the same kind of coverage as a Nikki Giovanni, the same kind of coverage as Emilia Baraka, the same kind of coverage even to a certain extent as Sonia Sanchez, because none of my books I would allow to be published by white people. Now I got essays and poems published in these anthologies, but in terms of all my books, Broadside Press, Lotus Press, we just lost the great creator of Lotus Press, Naomi Long Magic. She just died about a week and a half ago. Third World Press. So my commitment to Black people and to Black institutional development is number one. It has always been the highest level, all right? But I respect white people. You see what I'm saying? You know, I respect one of the brothers who you may know, Cornell, and you may know, Trish, is Tom Hartman. I've seen Tom, I met him once, but I've read many of his books. You check out Tom Hartman and his whole underground, overground series on the Supreme Court, on the Second Amendment, on voting, all right? And he deals with white supremacy. He deals with how the slave patrols created the modern police agencies in this country. So yes, but the key for me always is, I'm Du Boisian. I'm Malcolm to the bone, all right? You know, I'm Garvey to the bone. You see what I'm saying? I'm not leaving my culture just to, you know, just.
But
to,
you did end up being the first poet in residence in the Ivy League at Cornell.
That's
so
true.
You can go in that context, still be your real self, your courageous visionary self, and then leave that context, go to Howard, flying back and forth Chicago to Howard. How many years was that?
8 years. I told Howard for 8 years. And that's where
every
I met.
Week.
Yeah, every week. And they paid for it. Okay. I was one of the first professors in the country, Black professors in the country, to commute between DC and Chicago every week. And I had an apartment in DC. But Andrew Billingsley set that up. Okay, the great Andrew Billingsley, in terms of Clammy Jacob's Ladder, who was one of his major books, and his wife, the great Amy Billingsley. So yeah, so my point always is that I can look you in the eye and say, where's your commitment? What have you done? And so I think even the left, I was fighting with the left a lot too. I don't know if you saw that major issue of a Black scholar came out where the left attacked me for an essay I wrote in a book titled "In Enemies, A Clash of Races." But my point always is, I felt then as I do now, if the university structure, if the college structure did not exist, the modern left would not have a job, all right? My question was, what are you doing in the community each and every day? What are you building in the community? That's my part.
No, it's too much fighting the university, just fighting inside the university. Right, right. No, it's a real issue.
Right. What's the percentage of Black professors in the university today? Still less than 2 or 3%.
It's still so small.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So how are you thinking about the future of Black poetry in relationship to spoken word? You know, what do you think about the way spoken word has taken off and has really transformed the notion of what constitutes Western poetry at this moment?
Right.
or poetry in the West, not Western poetry. It's two different things. And with all this new digital technology, how can we, I asked you before about institution building, but now I'm thinking about publishing. How would you recommend that writers, young people who want to get into writing, how should they approach this new technology? And can that be a source for expanding the arguments and narratives and data and information that your commitment has been so much about?
I guess my first answer would be very careful with social media and the new media technology. There's a very important documentary out called The Social Dilemma.
I think we talked that
people need to look at that. That's number one. Number two, publishing, Third World Press is the oldest independent Black book publishing company in the world. And I'm transitioning out. I'll be on the board, but the new people who have taken over Third World Press are Dr. Michael Somanga down in Morehouse and Dr. Lasana Gazembe at IUPUI in Indianapolis. And these are two brothers who have been committed to Black struggle all of their adult lives also. And we're talking to now another sister, Dr. Ramik Crawford, who will probably be working with us also. So I think books will continue, whether they're published books or eBooks or what the case may be. I think that we have to be fearful, but also structurally ready for whatever comes our way. And that requires our coming together as family, extended families, and brothers and sisters like we're doing now, talking, thinking, and forecasting, contributing our resources. What I think is missing in the Black community are not just banks, but credit unions. I think Black credit unions are critical in terms as we move forward. Banks have been co-opted and are part of the ruling structure, and therefore have hurt us a great deal. But credit unions, especially when you get these large mega churches, if they can't build credit union in these churches or credit union in even the small churches, is a step forward in terms of as we move as a people. We got to have resources. We got to have money. So we talk about the Black middle class coming together, even in terms of your family, and begin to save together, pool your resources, and begin to say, okay, wherever we live, we need to own. Wherever we live, we need to own, okay? Mm-hmm. And to begin to move out and own it, move toward ownership of self, ownership of home, ownership of family, ownership is critical. And then the third thing is that we always have to be ready for war. I hate to say that, but that's what's happening. At one level, we got to be prepared at every level. And that's where my military training came in and is valuable. I didn't tell y'all this, and it's in my biography someplace. We bought a farm back in the 60s and 70s. We bought a farm in South Haven, Michigan, because we were getting ready for these crazy people to come after us. And we were getting ready to actually leave the city, go to the farm. Now, that's not realistic today. But today is we've got to stay on top of whatever's happening, not only in Chicago or New York, in the United States, but happening in the world. What's happening in Africa? And one of the benefits of my being a poet, I've been to Africa about 15 times, met with four African presidents, and have been able to have firsthand knowledge of how our brothers and sisters on the continent are doing. And I can tell you now, they're not doing well, okay? Mm-hmm. They're not doing well. Look at Nigeria. Nigeria's in serious trouble, all right? Look at South Africa. Apartheid still exists in South Africa, all right? My wife and I went to South Africa. She got an honorary degree from one of the major universities in South Africa. And we took the time to go around all of South Africa, and it's a gated community, okay? Mm. And Black people are basically in the service-oriented jobs, just like they are here. Ownership, 85% of the land is still owned by white people, which are an acute minority in South Africa, you see?
Wow.
And let me just read a poem. And I think this poem would tell you where I'm at on this. It's in Taught by Women. And the poem is titled Liberation Narratives.
And I which write, page? Which page is that, brother? So
page 10.
Oh, okay, right at the beginning.
One, it may be a man's world, yet it's women who write music that navigate the harmony that grows children, drives learning, prepare knives for the cutting of green beans and lies while dodging genocide and rape as men who run the world, bathe in a power of extreme illusion, overuse collateral damage and deficit language to justify it's a man's world. Number two, best advice to men, marry women smarter than you, and occasionally let them know it. Number three, my mother was prettier than imagination, soaked in honey, flavored with hot water and lemon. Her heart was there too. She was a short poem. Dead at 34, bare without flowers, notation, our truthful stories. She challenged men walking on her life like she was a used thread mill years before they were invented. I have her eyes. I see damage everywhere. I become a stop sign. Number four, Janet liked girls and told them so. Robert liked boys and kept it a secret. Both grew into teenagers, still liking girls and still liking boys. Each kept their desires to themselves. In the 21st century, parts of the world began to mature and finally understood why Janet loved women and Robert loved men. They were born that way. Enough said. Five, if poetry is to have meaning, it must mean something. More than metaphor and simile, more than tree talk and looking for gigs, more than competition and unrhymed free verse, seared to the bone of incomprehension, shooting to land the poet of Guggenheim or MacArthur genius grant. Artists should not expect from readers, listeners, and observers fairness, objectivity, a deep knowledge of wordplay, or interpreted ideas of paint or jumping notes. Often a smile will do. And yes, to buy and share books, visuals, and music will help. Saying yes to children may get you into heaven. Saying no to war bills, character, and conscience. Giving 10% of what you earn to the homeless will aid in your sleeping a full night, hopefully to awaken creating healthier poems, prose, pictures, and critical perceptions of the potential of the letter P beyond politics, potholes, profiteers, poverty, pimp juice, patriots, protestants, and playboys of the Western world. Number six, if you don't know who you are, anybody can name you. And number seven, if the world loses elephants, dolphins, polar bears, frogs, trees, the ability of the majority to do good, clean water, prayer, and meditation in all languages, love across borders, honest vegans and vegetarians, a mother's love, a father's caring, children dancing to knowledge and colors, artists not lying for money, privilege, or fame. If the world loses books, newspapers, clear thinkers, practical doers, poets, promising futures for the great majority, rainforest, a world vocabulary that accents yes and possibilities rather than no, and you can't do that. If the world loses the great apes, schools, giraffes, salmon, the coral reefs, insects, worms, organic farmers, compost, green tea, workers who use their hands to build and repair stuff, North and South Poles, teachers, people of faith, engineers, wheatgrass, carrot juice, oatmeal, and seven grain bread. If the world loses you and water, yes, precious you in the daily taste of life, it finally means that we lost butterflies yesterday and failed our children. And so poetry to me is essentially the answer in a way in which we can see the two oldest art forms basically is music and poetry. Music and poetry. And then visual arts come in there, you see. And so it's important for me, and I write this in the section on art two, reviewing a life of calling. If you go to page seven, I write through music that everyday art mandates, my life would have continued to revolve around reactions to the alphabet of hourly time cards, embracing of corporate white nationalism, fast walking urban streets, double-eyed, the ignorance of demeaning the others and their otherness, thinking that Citizen United is actually pro-citizen, locating identity and wearing label clothes, multicolored fingernails, and pants below the crack of one's ass, aware of Jim Crow and ignorant of Jane Crow, unaware that the creation, wealth, and building of America exists upon indigenous people's stolen land and African people's stolen intelligence and labor. And so without wonder words, involved music, inviting visuals, and flying feet, without reading books, without serious study of life's hopes and tangible, children will drink sports, rappers' realities, mall hopping, consumption, 24-hour cable surfing, all representing debilitating and limited information or knowledge needed to grow in superior intellect, families, and tomorrows to save our planet. Slow consumption, investigation of veganism, one good nutrition meal a day, juice more, walk 3 miles a day, drink water, understand the kindness of language of Gwendolyn Brooks. In her quietness and poetry existed her religion, and her life's work is summed up in, quote, "We are each other's harvest, we're each other's business, we're each other's magnitude and bond," end quote. Losing Gwendolyn Brooks was like the destruction of a major library.
Mm. Oh, that's
wow,
deep stuff.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
That's rich, rich stuff. That first poem was dedicated to Tarana, Tarana Burke.
Tarana Burke, yeah. She's a very important person, and I got her on the book also. She's on the cover of the book.
On the cover, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And
so there are so many women who go unnoticed, you know, the Fannie Lou Hamers of the world, you know, to just go unnoticed and are forgotten, the Diane Nashes of the world, okay. Or even the women of SNCC. I dedicate to the women of SNCC. You see?
Absolutely.
And just go unnoticed. And it starts and ends with love of Black people. That's it. Why do you do this? Why love Black people? Because I know where we are. We do what we do because we've been taught to do that. So we bring in our schools. We bring in the publishing company. We bring in these other institutions to say, okay, this is a different way to do it. This is how we got to take care of each other. All right, mm-hmm. First and foremost. And so any people were in control of their own cultural imperatives about the healthy replication of themselves, first and foremost. And don't apologize to anybody for that. The Irish did it, the Jews did it and continue to do it. All right, the Italians have done it and continue to do it. We are the only ones who do not do it at the level of other national groups. And that's it.
Yeah.
And so I'm gonna walk in anywhere and say that without apology to anybody, that we do not love ourselves, first and foremost, okay? And being this color, you know, I'm this color, Trisha, the color that she is, because these Neanderthals raped us from a continent and raped our women, okay? Raped our women, beat and sodomized our men, everything. I'm just saying, basically took our men and hung them and made them become breeders as enslaved Africans. And so essentially, this is what we are today. And what you got to understand is critical. We fought our way out of enslavement, but we came out of enslavement and these Neanderthals basically brought in the Black codes. Okay, and these Black codes became a new type of enslavement. And that's how these prisons became, you all know the history, these prisons became Macy Black.
Oh, indeed, indeed. But brother, you still got that fire. You're gonna be 80 years old the next year. That same day, I mean, Chan with W.B. Du Bois, February 23rd,
well,
her birthday.
Yeah. My husband's been trying to get me to be a vegan. I'm listening to you. I might have to do it now.
This fire, but that's come back to the commitment, though.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's
so important. You're one of the great ones of a great people, and greatness is defined by the scope of your commitment and courage and service to the least of these.
Thank you.
You see, out of my black church tradition, you see,
right?
Let my deeds speak for me.
Yes, indeed.
Haki Mahebute, let his deeds speak for him.
Yes, and they're speaking.
All those decades, all that love, all that consistency, all that constancy, all of that mess that he had to take, let his deeds speak. That's true for Safisha, that's true for so many others, but we're talking to Haki today. And that needs to be said. That's why we got you on the show, for the world to know.
Well, you've given us a beautiful time with you, Haki. We're gonna have to have you back, and maybe even just pick a book. Maybe we talk about a book together. I mean, you're just an extraordinary educator, and it comes through in everything you say and every and how you say it. And I don't just mean information. Right. Mm. I mean, you're interested in making sure that food, that education is food and nourishment for self-development. It comes through every sentence. So we're so happy you came to be on our tightrope. It didn't feel like a tightrope today. It felt like a big safety net today. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And there's one book that we did not publish that I gotta mention. Of course, all of Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson and all that stuff. But very few people, Cornell, know about Blueprint for Black Power, A Moral, Political, Economic Imperative for the 21st Century by the great Amos N. Wilson, who's not no longer with us.
Right.
He created
right.
so much work. Okay.
I don't know that book. Yeah. I forgot about that book.
Yeah. So no, Amos Wilson is on top of it. And so, but let me just say, ending this, is that I appreciate and love both of you so much, because you don't have to do this. I mean, both of you have careers that are set in stone. And I remember when I first met Cornell, when Grace Matters came out, and we've been brothers ever since.
Right. Just
wow, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed that.
He just flowed, you know. He just
oh yeah, he don't play. He's all set. I mean, he's rare. He's a poet and a preacher, really.
I'm telling you, but he got that fire.
He's still on fire.
He's still on fire. Almost 80 years old.
He listed all the things I'm supposed to do: be a vegan, meditate, and walk 3 miles a day. I'm really not doing so good on that list, Cornell.
Going on that list. I said, no, I don't. I got the no set on that front right there.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on The Tightrope. We had a fantastic time today. We really appreciate you being part of our community. So pass on what you found. Subscribe to YouTube and share our show with all your friends and family. And let us know how you're feeling about The Tightrope. And we'll love to hear from you again soon. Cornell, it's always a pleasure. We're going to see you next time on The Tightrope. You're going to be there, right, bro?
I always salute you, my dear sister Tricia.
All right. We're going to be there together. Take good care, everybody. We'll see you again next time.